But there is a way for you to get power if you stop that narrative and start with the possibility narrative, the abundance narrative. The opportunity is there for me. I just need to find it. How can I strategically make something out of nothing? Which, in my opinion, is the real American dream. Rich people buying property, they can do that all day long, and that's not gonna stop. The people who have the gold make the rules. That's the golden rule, right? So how do I get to a place without attacking them, because we already know that's not a winning proposition, and find my own power in the system that exists already, which there are ways to do. Right exactly. Now, there are ways to do.
But because the majority of people haven't had financial literacy classes or any education around buying real estate, leveraging real estate, anything around that, you know, instead of looking at it from an empowered standpoint, it's from a disempowered standpoint, right, that looks at it like this unattainable thing that I'll never be able to get. Whereas, you know, and so, and that's just,
what I mean.
Yeah, that just like further helps that propaganda land, because now you're talking to people who feel like you're empathizing with them, you know, but you're not telling them how they can join the appreciation, how they can, you know, build the foundation so they don't feel left behind but feel included. That's the real issue.
Yep. You know? I will never stand for people feeling stuck in this country of opportunity. Mm. We still have it. Let's exploit that. Yeah. Y'all make that thing. Under all is the land, the real estate. Courtney, your friends about to show you how to generate wealth. Get educated, do for yourself. Add a couple notches to your belt. Under all is the land. Under all is the land. The real estate. Under all is the land. Under all is the land. The real estate. Coming to you live from Acme Real Estate. Welcome to Under All is the Land, Season 5, Episode 4. I am your host, Courtney Polis, here with my rockstar co-stars, Silke Fernald.
Hello.
And Dominique Madden.
Hello.
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 How are you guys today?
Good.
Doing a little walk down memory lane. Yes. Talking about the toys we used to play with when we were kids. I saw this thing that said, like, okay, I don't know about you, but when I was a kid, I mean, my mom, the rule was basically just come home before it gets dark. Like,
pretty much.
My mom had no idea where I was or what I was doing. And a lot of times I wasn't doing anything bad, but I was just doing curious shit, like crawling into dumpsters to see if anybody threw something cool away, or like, you know, hiding in bushes and creating little dens out of stuff I found, or, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. But stuff that I'd be like, I'm not going to let my kid do that today. Yeah. Like, on purpose. What did you guys do after school?
I took my bike and I was gone until
What were you
dawn.
Doing?
I don't know. Like, we were just driving around the neighborhood, riding on our bikes and meeting at the playground and sitting and chatting. And
what were you talking about?
Boy. I don't know. But okay. It was just like, okay, we just, you know, we went to the play. There was like this little, I remember at the end of our street, it was this like forest you don't go to.
Ooh.
Because I don't know what can happen, and we're like, that's where we're going.
Yeah,
with our bikes in that forest. I'm like, this is creepy and cool, and we're not supposed to be here.
All the pedophiles live in that forest.
I mean, I don't know what that was. Like, I don't know. Never met one. Never saw one. It's like it's little forest, whatever.
That's
it
would be so, like, you know, funny.
Just fun, just things. And
yeah,
just hang out at the playground and run. Oh my god, went to the bakery. I don't know if you remember. If they have, I don't know if they have that here.
What, they give the kids had, a
like,
free the, thing?
No, there's like the bakery, and it's like all these like candies on the top with the display, right? And there's all the candies on the top, and you would be like, okay, you had like one mark at
yeah.
the time.
Yeah.
And you'd be like, okay, 10 of this, one yeah. of this, one of this, and then she would be have this little paper, and like, it took forever to fulfill the order, right? And it's like kids in line. I'm like, that's yeah. her job.
Yep.
We were like taking the thing and
penny
like
candy,
eating the whole
freaking
thing. It was just, and the candy that like
that pops in
pops
your mouth.
In your mouth.
Like Pop Rocks?
Pop Rocks.
Yeah.
Whatever they called it.
What do they call them in Germany?
I have no idea. They might have called it Pop Rocks. But
well,
anyway,
I
it was
remember
so fun.
There
I
were,
loved that.
There were ponds near where we lived at different like rental like developments, because I'm from Penn State, where there's just so many places for students to live off campus. There were just tons and tons of these developments. They had little like water features that would get frozen in the winter, and I'd go and ice skate by myself in these little ponds.
I remember doing that
no
too.
No fear that I'm gonna fall through at all.
Yeah.
Like all that, and I also sold Olympic cards and gifts door to door.
Oh.
Because there were things I wanted that I couldn't afford, and I knew I could do it. I found them in the back of a comic book, like, you can win these prizes if you sell this amount of cards. So I would go door to door, which again is something, if my son was like, Mom, can I go door to door in LA? I'd be like, oh no, you're not.
Definitely not. By yourself.
Let's circulate that online. But it's a good experience having the door closed in your face when you're 8 years old, you know. Mm-hmm. But when they wouldn't buy one thing, I'd try and sell them something else. So one time I tried to sell them bookmarks, which I laminated myself with tape, which I'm sure looked this
horrible. Awesome.
Horrible looking things, I'm sure, but only 25 cents.
I remember something.
So how can you say no? Yeah. You know? So yeah, it was an emotional.
Yeah.
It was that, okay, fine. Like the 8-year old with the self-laminated, she must really need 25 cents.
Yeah.
What was the total made of that from that excursion?
I really don't remember. Where it all ended for me was when I decided I was going to make a community newspaper, but I was going to write it by hand. Mom had given me like a big roll of newsprint. And after school every day, I'd try and write gossip blogs. So like I was trying to make it, I had a ruler and I was like trying. And I think I got through about a page and a half handwritten of like things. And I was like, I can't do this.
Yeah.
It was like, I knew my limitations.
Just
at that
things
point.
It was just slower. We did so many more things that, you know,
yeah, but
things,
you know,
took longer to make. And
the process of thinking,
yes,
was different too. And I saw this post by Sophia Amoroso on, from Girl Boss on Instagram. And she's like, these are the things I wish I would have learned in school. And, you know, it's like basic stuff, but I wonder, you know, how much we, like how we are prepared to teach our kids the stuff they're going to need to know in the future. You can't really predict. All I know is that that lack of stuff when I was little made me creative. And it made me feel like if I wanted something, I really had to work for it.
Yeah.
Which we admire in American society, like good work ethic. But I don't know that it taught me to work smarter. You know,
no.
I think I had to burn out a few times before I figured out, okay, I should use my brain more. And my,
it was definitely,
you know,
more
my
like
time
a work
less.
Harder, not smarter time.
Yeah.
But did you record the top 10 on like your tape thing? Did
yes.
you ever...
Okay. I mean, I
remember
the songs
sitting
that I
there
liked.
Like, yeah, that was so fun. Every Friday they were like,
and we had
top
a microphone
10.
That plugged into the tape deck. So I'd go in the room, I'd put on my mom's clothes, including her heels, and I'd stand in the mirror with the microphone and I'd go, "This is Courtney reporting live from blah blah blah." And I pretended I was a news broker and I would a news anchor and I would record it, you know, and then play
That's
it back.
Fun.
I'd read the newspaper that way. I did a lot of things when I was young
so
with
fun.
Boredom. What'd you do?
Well, I thought I was a forensic investigator.
Ooh.
So I was always trying to find some shit to put under a microscope.
You know
That's
what?
Cool.
That relates to real estate. Yeah.
That's true. That's true. And I thought I was a spy. So I also was taking down neighborhood gossip in my little journal.
Course.
And reporting it on my walk girl, or what was it? Talk girl, whatever. You know, well,
like the little
know.
Walkman.
But it was like, no. It was
but you
like,
had a microphone.
Okay, you know on Home Alone, the little thing he walks around and talks into?
Yeah.
It was one of those.
That. Okay,
oh,
yeah.
I think it was called
gen.
A Talkman or Talk Girl, but there was a boy and a girl version.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And I had the girl version. And anyway, it was so fun, and I loved it so much. And we just like hide out wherever and then watch like all the older teenagers and what they were doing and report on that, you know?
Yes. I see 16-year-old smoking cigarettes over there behind the dumpster.
or like, just, you know, just get into stuff generally. Like, what can we find to do? You know, like this. I mean, we were from the safest town, literally ever.
Right.
But there was one girl who went missing one Halloween. Yeah, she went missing.
Oh,
did she return?
Her name was Cindy Song.
No,
she never.
Did not
she was
return.
Never found.
Oh,
no.
Oh my God.
And
she was a Penn State student, right?
She was a Penn State student. She was like out at a party, you know, and that night she went missing. So like the next, you know, like whenever this came up, I don't even know if it was really the next day, but you know, once it came out, my friends and I are like, well, we're gonna find her, you know? So we're like going around the apartment complex that she, you know, was in that was right behind us, right? And like finding little clues, like tomatoes that were on the ground. We're like, oh, she must have been carrying these tomatoes.
Oh.
They're spread all over the sidewalk.
Oh,
it looks like
God.
She's headed in this direction, you know?
Wow. Oh my God, love that.
Yeah. You created your fun back then.
Yeah,
for sure.
For sure.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Isn't there this commercial? Sean was telling me there was a commercial in the 80s around 10 or 9 o'clock where the
oh
TV
God,
said, do you know where your children are?
Yeah. Yeah,
like because parents had no clue.
Yeah,
and it's like, this is your reminder. It's dark. Maybe you want to see that they're home.
Maybe you should check. And make
I was
sure you know
cracking
where your
up when
are.
I heard
your
that.
Children are.
Yeah,
yep.
That
it's
is
true.
So funny. We didn't have that in Germany, but I love that.
Yeah,
that is so funny.
They did have.
Can
that.
Can you imagine?
That is true. It's fun to walk down memory lane sometimes, just to remind us mm-hmm. how we got here. And things are constantly changing. One of the things that we talked about on our last episode were the changes around financing of ADUs, accessory dwelling units, and California laws around how they can be resold and subdivided. ADUs have been around for a few years, but we're still investigating the value of them from a resale point of view, like which is better, the garage or the ADU? And really like what the future value of them will be, you know, because mm-hmm. as housing, you know, is a commodity, it's like having additional space on your property becomes a value, you would think. So here to break down all things ADU is Jackie Weissman of Go ADU Construction. Welcome, Jackie.
Woo. Thank you so much.
Yeah, we're happy to have you here because we have lots of questions for you around ADUs. So you are in construction and you build, and this is your own company too, right?
Correct. I have it with my husband. We've been doing this for a while and we really are very passionate about the ADU business.
What is it that makes you so passionate? Why do you love it?
So, I mean, because it really changed my life. Like, not to sound super cheesy or anything, but I'll just go there. We built our first ADU in 2017. And the idea was when we bought our first house, we really wanted to build a guest house to subsidize our mortgage. So we bought sort of like at the top. We pulled like every penny that we could find to buy at the top of our budget, knowing that we were going to make this investment and have it pay off in the long run. And financially, it really saved us. It worked out. I mean, we cover the majority of our mortgage with ADU. So I'm like
still to this day.
Yeah, especially mm-hmm. when the interest rates were really low and we refinanced. So I'm like super gung-ho about them.
Yep.
Did you convert your garage or did you add an extra structure?
We converted the garage. So that was part of it. We got lucky because the garage was partially converted. So mm-hmm. we had electricity already and water, which saved us a lot of money when we did it.
That's actually a really important question because a lot of times when we're selling real estate, we see garage conversions that were done without permits probably years and years ago when maybe they weren't even needed or people just didn't do, they weren't trying to convert them into ADUs, let's say, legally. It was just kind of like bonus space. So you can still work with that. You don't have to redo everything whenever there's electricity that goes out to that.
Correct.
Structure, for example.
Absolutely, yeah. And depending on what the work is that's done, it can really save the person a lot of money because, yeah, exactly. You can work with what's there already in many cases.
What's the cheapest ADU you've ever done?
The cheapest, well, the question is it before the price increases around 2020, 2021 of raw materials or after? Because it's like a really night and day.
Well, okay, how has it changed? That. Like how bad?
I mean,
is it
I
now?
Can tell you just in full transparency because I believe in being super transparent with prices. Like before 2020, we could probably build an ADU for around 70K, let's say. That would be on the cheaper side of like maybe a studio or a one bedroom.
And build, you mean build from scratch or convert?
Convert.
Okay, got it.
And now it's, you know, significantly more. It's about, we end up, our prices are around between $250 to $350 per square foot, depending on,
finishes. And
mm-hmm. Exactly. I think that's a real key. And depending on what the main house already has, they have an upgraded electrical panel that we can use to help power the ADU. But overall, I like to give that range as sort of a general.
So the ADU doesn't need its own electrical panel?
No, not necessarily. What okay. we've done in the past is we'll get like a splitter. Mm-hmm. So you can actually, in some cases, track if you have like, if you know, tenants, right? You can track how much is
They're
being
spending.
Used by the front and how much is being used by the back.
Right. So you do new construction of ADUs as well?
Absolutely. We specialize in garage conversions, but we're seeing more and more people want new constructions, even if they don't have, like let's say they have an attached garage, but they want a detached space for like an office or a rental. We're starting to see that more and more.
And how is the pricing for those?
It is on the upper end because you're not taking advantage of the existing structure.
So it's still in the 350 per square foot or higher?
Yeah, it's more in the 350 range.
Okay.
So
like people ask us all the time, what's more valuable, the garage or the ADU? And if it costs how much does it, like, say it's a 450 square foot garage, mm-hmm. right? That's like a two-car garage, right?
Yeah.
So how much would that cost versus building it new in real dollars?
In real dollars?
Yeah.
I mean, I think you're looking at about, if you're converting the garage, it's so hard.
I know, this isn't a science. I just mean, like, is it 150 to convert and 350 to build new, or?
It just, you know, also from real estate, it depends so much on, like, what's the nature of the property? You know what I mean? Like, is it on a hill? Is it sloped? Is mm-hmm. it, like, it's so variable. But that's why I always just try and give a general range. And then mm-hmm. once we go out and scout the property.
Well, we talked about the price per square foot, but we didn't talk about, like, if it was 450 square feet or 400 square feet, what that actually equates to in real dollars and cents. 120 to 140 for a conversion, roughly.
And we work with all budgets, so we also have a project going right now that's, you know, just under 100. So it really depends on, like, people's preferences. That's why I'm always a little bit hesitant, but I know people mm-hmm. want a number. So.
They do. They want to know because, yeah, we want to know.
So are you a contractor, or do you help with the process?
Okay, let me be totally, my husband's the licensed contractor.
Okay, cool.
So, but I'm very familiar with the building process because when we did our first ADU, which was for ourselves, we did it as owner builders. It was before mm-hmm. he had his license. Mm-hmm. So it was he and I just, like, in the trenches, wow. going to the city, dealing with the architect, dealing with, you know, like, the subs, dealing with all of this stuff. So we learned we became intimately acquainted with the process. And mm-hmm. then when we would have people over in our backyard, they would ask us a lot of questions about the ADU. And so they, you know, we would sort of come on as, like, an unofficial consultant. So we got a lot of experience that way. And then my husband went and he made it official. He put a ring on it. He got licensed. And then the rest is history.
Yeah. Okay. And do you have
Do you
have long-term tenants in there, or is it in?
That's a good question. As far, like, since we built it, are they the same tenants?
No, just in general. Do you usually have the same person, or is it like two nights here, four nights there?
We usually do for our tenants is, yeah, they'll sign a year contract. We've mm-hmm. had them, you know, different, maybe about three or four tenants since we built it. They tend to, I don't know if you see this in your experience, because I know you also do rentals, but I do think the ADU has a lot more value for people who have pets, for example, than like an apartment, renting an apartment
100%.
So you see that people want to stay longer, in my experience, as a rental unit with ADUs. But yeah, we've had several in our own personal ADU.
Well, definitely over the pandemic, people found a lot of values in the ADUs because they're set apart, you know, so instead of being in one of those big buildings where you're worried about how many people you were around, especially then, we saw a lot of people moving to smaller buildings.
Absolutely. Yeah, that was a huge, like, the whole sort of safety consideration of not having to share an elevator with people when you're, mm-hmm. you know, going downstairs and stuff. And I found that the pet factor is really, you know, as long as the owner of the ADU is okay with pets, that's like, you can create, like, a garden for them. They can have space for their animals, or, like, it's a sweet, like, living deal if you can get into one.
Is there a big difference between building in LA City versus LA County?
There are, like, slight differences, but overall I think
similar.
That, yeah, especially since a lot of the ordinances were passed sort of on the state level. So,
right.
I haven't really encountered some huge glaring differences between both.
And now they have the pre-approved plans, yes. right? So let's talk about that.
I'm very excited about that because that's one of the biggest questions that clients have is, like, how long is this process going to take me? They're eager to get it started.
Yep.
And, you know, there's a lot of, like, one of the main things that's out of your control in this business is what happens once you submit things to the city.
Ain't that the truth? Say that again. Say it one more time. Because
with the people in the back.
Yes, say
yeah,
it.
Seriously, it's out of your hands. And so there's one plan that the city of Los Angeles has. This is sort of a caveat to your question. There's one plan that you can use free of charge. It's a one bedroom, one bathroom ADU. And you can use those plans without having to pay. There's about 15 other ones that are on the website. They're all pre-approved, but you have to pay. I don't know if it's technically called, like,
A licensing fee
or something like that. But, you know, it's a solid. It'll raise the cost. I don't remember.
I looked into this.
City council member's wife is the architect on those ones you have to pay for.
You know what? I actually looked into this. And actually, they're submitted by, they're different architects.
Yes.
Like, people can submit these things. I don't know how they are chosen to be part of that umbrella, but
they're
not
expensive.
Cheap. Yeah, they're expensive.
What are we talking
for
about?
You to get the
give me numbers. Five digits.
I reached out.
Yeah, five digits.
Yeah, oh, I reached out to someone to see. You know, they had a really nice floor plan. I was like, this is actually perfect for what I'd like, and I think it was like $40,000.
For the floor plan?
You have approved plans.
For the plan.
Yeah.
So if you didn't have, if you didn't use one of those pre-planned, pre-approved plans,
yeah,
how much would plans typically cost? Like just the architectural plans and submission process, just generally.
You working with the architect, it depends on what the person wants and how many revisions they want, because that's like how many back and forth rounds. But I would say let's say around plus or minus 30%. It could be around 10K, let's say.
So the plans online could even be more expensive than just finding your own architect and doing,
but because they're
pre-approved, and you're paying for the premium, not having to wait.
Right. Oh, right.
So they stamped, and you start breaking ground once you buy these plans.
What's that?
You start breaking ground once you start the project.
I've never used them, to be totally honest. We've only worked with architects, but in theory, that exactly.
So they basically stamped.
Wow, but you know that is interesting that they have a free one.
They have one
that people can use, because that means that if you're down with that floor plan, then you can expedite your ADU process so much.
Right, which
that's crazy.
Makes sense for a lot of developers since they're so crunched on their timelines. So no more excuses, developers.
Seriously.
But the city they say, I was going to convert the ADU, but because of the timeline. Yeah. Although,
but the city would still have to come out, though, right, to make sure that what you're trying to do is actually
according
doable.
To the plans, right. Absolutely, yeah.
So that your setback is right and
exactly. And let that. Since we do mostly garage conversions, those plans, if I'm not mistaken, are only for new constructions. They're not for garage conversions. Oh. So that might be. Don't quote me on it, but I'm pretty sure, because I've looked into it quite a bit, but I'm pretty sure that's the case.
I would say the majority of the inquiries I get from my clients are around converting the garage, because I think, and I've said it before, but there may be data to support this. I just forget where I got the information from many years ago. But backyards and garages are the most overvalued and underused features of real estate. So people are like, I want a huge yard, but they don't ever use their yard. Mm-hmm. Or they'll say like, I need a two-car garage, but they park in the driveway. Why? Because when you're bringing groceries in, if you have a detached garage that's in the back of your property, you're not gonna park in it and haul your groceries up to the front. Haul. You know, you're gonna do the shortest distance between two points, which tends to be right beside the door.
I totally agree with you.
I'm just picturing you hurling groceries. Take the middle.
Take this fucking grocery. I was thinking like a pulley system could be cool. You know, you just get them out of the car, put them on a thing, you're like do, and they end up in the kitchen.
I'm just gonna line up my elves.
Oh my god, I'm on a hill, I have a steep hill. So for me, parking in the driveway and like bringing the groceries in is like a thing. It's like I'm like walking up the hill with heavy bags.
That's and cardio. That counts.
It does count. It totally counts. That's why I've got this Apple booty. I'm working on it. Anyway, I digress.
But I do agree with you, and I would add to that, even like a pool is something in my experience. I mean, I haven't owned very many homes, but it's like, you know, pools are one of those things that are in theory, you know, I'm always like, oh, I'm gonna use it every day, I'm gonna swim laps, and I'm gonna like get so in shape, and I'm gonna probably use it like I can count on, you know, two hands how many times a year I use
it's true,
even in LA, where it's so warm and sunny.
It is true. There's a there's like a country club that you can be on the wait list to join, and I think when I first moved there, it was like $10,000 or $15,000 for a lifetime membership, and then you have like a minimum amount you have to spend every month. And I was like, well, that's so expensive, you know? And I had a pool, so we just always use a pool. Now the price of membership has gone up way more, but still, I'm trying to build a pool in my backyard, and still the cost of membership is hundreds of thousands of dollars less than the cost to actually build a pool.
No way.
Yeah, hundreds of thousands of dollars less. And for me, I'm going on like year three of trying to get this thing done. So definitely, pools have value for resale. They don't get used very much, but there is a value in the resale. Mm-hmm. And I think garages, same thing, and backyards, same thing. But if you actually have a functioning ADU, it allows you to leverage your asset up into the next part of your real estate journey. So for me, ADUs are most valuable for first-time homebuyers to do just what you said. Make sure you're hedging against any economic changes, that you always have somebody supplementing your mortgage. It gives you flexibility. You can do Airbnb or you can do long-term tenants. You know, you have these choices. But you know, as you move up, then it turns your one unit into a two unit property. So there's the value right there. You know, you can make even more money on it the longer you hold it.
Well, and it's so hard to get into the market in Los Angeles. So it's like any way that you can supplement your, like reduce your mortgage payments is welcomed. And I did hear what you were saying before I walked in, because the new sort of underwriting laws is, as far as considering the rental income from an ADU as part of the underwriting, which before was not the case. Mm-hmm. It was only multifamilies, right, that were part of that. And that, yep, I think is going to be, that's huge. A huge game changer. Because,
huge.
Yeah, you know, I always think about ADUs in this way. Like, you're not building, in some cases, with some of these 1,200 square foot ADUs, you're building a house. Mm-hmm. You're not just building, converting a garage. You know, like, you are building a house, and you're getting, it's the value makes sense because you're not paying for the land, and that's really so expensive in LA. So it's like, if what's like is sort of an average cost per square foot for a home, including the land in LA, is it fair to say $500 to $1,000 per square foot?
That depends what area, but
the rule of, I always say price per square foot is a terrible way of looking at real estate, not to just say that. There are places where you can buy land. The usability of the land is a big part of the value in LA. Mm. You know, people want to live in the hills. The hills are difficult to build in. The price of the land is cheaper, but the cost of the construction is higher. Mm. You know, so in the flats, you'll get the land for more expensive because it's flat and ready to build. So, you know, a lot in the Hollywood Hills could be a couple hundred grand, and you're like, wow, this place has amazing views, but it's going to take you 15 years to get through Department of Building and Safety to do all the engineering you need to do to have a structure on that hill. Whereas you could say, wow, $500,000 for a 4,000 square foot lot in Atwater seems high, but if you can build on that thing in 1 year, you can sell something for profit, you know, very easily. So land is a funny thing, but yeah. So there's no like real, but price per square foot, you have to make sure when you're using that as a metric that you're using apples to apples. So if you're comparing price per square foot on houses, for example, like an average resale price of a house, you have to make sure it's exactly the same square footage, because obviously the smaller the square footage, the higher the price per square foot, and it's in the exact same location, like it's in Los Feliz in the same couple of blocks, you know, that they have the same kind of neighborhood school conditions, district. School districts, all that stuff.
Same condition. Yeah, aesthetic level. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like the scientists, like the you know, in football they have, what do they call them? Armchair quarterbacks or something. But it feels like that with people who use price per square foot when they're trying to compare houses. You can go this way or that way. You know, whatever case you want to make. Now that's just an educational seminar for the people out there. not to make any point about you being wrong about anything.
No, but it's, I mean, I'm not a real estate agent, so I appreciate the education, I'm not going to lie. But I will say that, you know, going back to what you were saying about the price per square foot, that like, that's what, how we sort of look at the value of an ADU is like looking at what's the value of your home per square foot. And I'm curious to know all of your thoughts, if you think this is a fair way to look at it. And then whatever you're building as far as livable space goes with this garage conversion or ADU, that's more or less the value that it would have? Or is it more or less because it's a multi-unit, or is it less because it's, you know, how do you kind of...
I wouldn't say that it adds the same value as like price per square foot.
In the main house,
yeah, for sure.
It doesn't.
Like, you know, I would say, it's really hard to say, it's really hard to quantify that, because it also depends on where it is. You know, even like valuing an ADU, right? Like, some people want a place to park. Like, you know, so they don't necessarily need a garage, but they need a driveway. Maybe they need a private parking, so they need a gate. So if they have an ADU, but they have no driveway and no gate, now that ADU actually just made that
a liability.
It could now be a liability. Whereas if there's a great driveway and they have somewhere to park, then now this ADU is great. You know, that could be an awesome option, because now we've got these other options, but now we've got this income. So it really depends. It depends on the property.
That's very interesting.
Yes. But I do think one of the things about accessory dwelling units that is not true of guest houses and not true of permitted rec rooms and all these other pre-ADU things that were legal living square footage is that it appears on your tax record as combined square footage. The previous things, even legal guest houses, did not appear on the tax record as living square footage. So whenever you're comparing price per square foot from a metric data point of view, you will see combined square footages for the main house and the guest house. But in reality, who sets the value? Buyers set the value. Right. And they will never value the accessories square footage more than the one that they primarily like live in, you know?
That makes total sense because, at the end of the day, it's like, like you said, there's the main house and then there's the back house.
Right. And if you have like a, say, you know, 3-bedroom, 2-bath houses are the typical like bare minimum for most people who have a people living in the house that are going to be 2+, you know? So 2-2 works for 2, you know? 3-2 is like the minimum for anybody that's, say, expanding a family or wants to have roommates or whatever. And then, you know, the bonus structure in this post-COVID world has so many purposes.
Totally.
That, to me, is the real value. It's not in it, the structure. It's in the multiple options for use.
Totally.
It's work from home. It's guest space. It's rental income. It's the place where I do ballet, whatever.
Well, and it's so funny that you say that because we had clients that when they bought their house, the detached garage was converted into sort of a bonus room. It was just very beautiful. You know, they're like, oh, it's going to be a playroom for our kid. But then they realized they were sort of leaving money on the table by not having like a fully functional ADU. Whether or not they chose to use it that way is a different story. But
right.
Knowing that they have the option, so we ended up helping them build out their, you know, turning it into an actual converted ADU that so they can use it as an office or as a play space for their kid. But if down the line, if, you know, things get hard financially,
it's
they can
option.
Rent it out. Yeah,
exactly.
And that's the other advice I had a friend actually who enlisted my help, and they were about to buy a house and they had the garage and they're like, well, how much is it going to cost us to do a bonus room versus an ADU? And I was like, look, and I hope this doesn't come off as biased, but like my professional recommendation is just, if you can't do it now, just wait and do the ADU later, because you don't want to pay for a bonus room
right. And
then change your mind and have to kind of start. You don't start from zero, but you do lose a lot of time and money. So I just said, it's better to do nothing, in my opinion, than cut yourself off from the option of using this as a potential rental stream in the future, knowing how expensive LA is.
Mm-hmm. So we have some laws in California related to ADUs.
We do.
That people are trying to decipher. So we'd love your point of view on SB 9.
Absolutely.
Tell us what you think.
So, I mean, for anyone who's listening, SB 9 essentially allows, just, you know, giving it the simplest explanation possible, you take a lot, you divide it into two. And because of the ADU ordinance that passed in the state of California in 2017 that allowed two units on each lot, you can technically have 4 units. You can, let's say, have your main house and an ADU and then maybe 2 other units on the other lot. So that is sort of the spirit of the law. I think, you know, from my understanding, you know, it hasn't been wildly successful in the same way that, you know, building ADUs has been wildly successful in California. And I'm curious to see if what happens, well, I guess I'm getting ahead of myself with AB 1033, but
right.
What happens once that comes into effect. But that's the gist of it, is that
right.
You can subdivide.
You can subdivide your land, you can build additional units on it, and this is like a solution to the housing crisis, which is arguably a different crisis, but anyway. and then AB 1033 says, now that you built this thing and you subdivided this thing, now you can sell it as a condo.
Exactly. And that, you know, one of the instances that I've spoken to, you know, lenders and people sort of in the industry and how they see this coming to life, since it hasn't actually taken effect yet. But one example is, you know, the older couple that they bought their house in 1980, they retired. They're living on really, you know, low Social Security or retirement.
Like a fixed income.
Exactly. You know, it's not enough to get by. And so what they could do is build an ADU, either move into the back, and if they want to sell the front house, they can, or sell it off to people who are looking to get into the real estate market but have been priced out. So that's one interesting, I think, example of it. The research that I've done has said that one person said they foresee really selling it at the beginning to family members, and close friends.
That's interesting.
That is very interesting.
Like, I have a son who hasn't been able to afford a house, so I'm going to build this ADU, sell it to him, so he starts getting, he gets in.
He gets in, and he also gets the tax benefits of mortgage interest deduction. And if in LA, you want your kid to have that, but he can't independently afford to buy something because the prices are high, I never thought of that.
No, it was weird. Awesome. I didn't think of it either.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it was because there is a, you know, there's a lot of questions of like, what is it going to look like to be in essentially an HOA with people, right?
Yeah,
like,
with other people. Yeah.
So that's one way, is like a close friend or a family member you could sell it to in order to sort of get their foot in the door.
So the lender on the last episode thought maybe the whole condominium ownership was going to be rethought, because condominiums come with a whole set of rules as far as reselling those loans on the secondary mortgage market, that having an HOA that's tied to the neighbor, it's like a little bit weird. It's like, doesn't quite fit in with the current way we resell loans. So it could become a specialty lending kind of a thing, more like TICs or tenants in common.
Yes, exactly.
So personally, I think it's a better idea, especially if you're going to sell it to somebody that's a family member, which is a great option for building legacy wealth. I love that. Is to just make it a regular resale, like a structure on land where the land comes with it, and lose the whole condo thing. I just don't know who wins with the condo thing.
It is.
Seems like more difficult to finance, more difficult to resell. And you have to create an HOA with people who ultimately might end up being like neighbors in the front yard that you have no relationship with, because your parents are gonna move.
But then you probably have to create a second APN number for each land. Has its own
it APN does have number. Its own APN number, though. That's what she's saying, is that SB9 allows you to subdivide the land,
right,
build the structures, and then the condo is the way you resell the structure, right?
That's how I understood it as well. Exactly.
So it does have a separate APN. Why the HOA ties the two together is because you're living on essentially what was once was the same lot.
Right.
But under normal, so maybe there's access, there's easements that have to go across the property.
That's what I was saying. Title will be complicated.
It will be ridiculous.
And then what if you want to put a fence? And then, well, there's this fence now, but you can do it because it's a different land and it's owned by somebody else.
Right. So the HOA agreement would allow people to decide how they want to address those access issues and have it be this established recorded document. And then that document goes with the property. We used to do that with deed restrictions, you know, like covenants.
It runs with the land.
It runs with the land. So if there's a permission for access or a fence to be built or a yard to be divided, that could all be on the deed. I'm thinking that that's why they wanted it to be an HOA kind of a thing, because then you can decide, okay, we are deciding right now one dog, you know, per house, or one dog for this back area, or something, because you're living on the same land. It's just, it has all kinds of things about it that could be weird.
I mean, but your take on it makes a lot of sense, actually, that's the purpose of it. Because I've asked myself the same question, too, and I haven't really, come to any sort of conclusions. But that makes a lot of sense, what you're saying.
Yeah. So, people out there, it seems like good business to create this condo process management firm right now, because it's going to be a shit show. Somebody's going to need to pay for those services. Anybody want to go into business? DM us. What would your concerns be about subdividing the land and creating a sellable ADU on its own land?
Just the closeness of it all, and then you have to like walk, because the garage is set at the back of the property, and then you walk past somebody's kitchen window to get to your house.
See, but I feel like,
and
you
it's
walk
sort of
past
like,
people's houses, well, to get to your house.
But you don't, not
anyway.
Like that. It's you
it's
are
intimate.
Close. It's close.
Intimate.
Somebody opens their backyard, their door to the backyard, and you see they're sitting on the couch or whatever, and then you come out of your ADU and you're like, hey, what's up?
Really, neighbor?
What are you watching on TV?
But again,
you know, it's very
next
close
door.
It's communal, but it's different, because when you're in a building, you're still, it's separated.
A lot of times there's a fence dividing.
You're not,
I'm saying, even in neighborhoods
looking
that are high density, you can look in your kitchen. I sell so many houses where I'm standing at the kitchen. Like, I think a lot of houses that were built in like the 30s have kitchens that face the neighbor's property. You know,
yes.
Standing in the kitchen,
yes,
looking in the bedroom window of the neighbor.
But there's a fence.
Yeah, but the fence law says you can only build a fence, what, 6 feet?
And you know,
well, and there's not always
if
a
when
fence.
The neighbors agree, you can put toppers on and make it as tall as you want
you
to.
Can, but people don't. I'm just saying, you could do the same thing here.
So, well, where do you put your fence if you have to use the driveway to get to your ADU?
You would have the driveway, you'd have your parking, and then you'd enter through a tall fence, and you go into the back, and you create whatever privacy you need. I'm not saying it's ideal. Well, it's a starter home situation,
no matter
what.
We're just bitching about
it. But I'm just saying, like, I can see possibilities where it could be something.
Sure.
Yeah, for sure.
Better than a condo for people that have pets, like, for example.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it creates a lot of opportunity, but, like, one of the big... One of the things that people are most up in arms about it, right, is that it does take single family streets that are otherwise not as high density and turns them into streets that are higher density.
Right.
You know, and
cars and
people who are looking for single families rather than condos, which we do get a lot of buyers who are specifically looking for single families, not duplexes, triplexes, condos, you know, they're looking for that suburban street quality that isn't high density. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's one of the things that's gonna complicate this, is all the people who are really frustrated by the streets density changing.
It's and then doubling the cost.
And another thing
have
that I think,
parking space.
I was gonna say another thing that's concerning is...
Although you don't, if you're within a half mile of public transit.
Exactly, so that's another thing, is the lack of parking. We already have such a parking issue. I could see that being a huge thing once people are actually putting four properties on each lot.
Gosh, and imagine two adults, that's two cars, that's eight cars per parcel. Or
And they don't build much parking. They build a lot of apartments, but they don't
parking.
Build much parking.
That is so true.
And it's definitely not free parking either. So
That's another business idea. How can we solve for the parking, you know, issues in the city with I know, like, in some places
we stack it and do the fancy.
I have one of those lift things, hydraulic lifts. Remember at the Detroit house? Do you remember it? And it was terrifying.
I'm sure.
Just FYI.
Yeah,
terrifying to have a big car on top of you.
Yeah, and it's and moving up and down, right?
Yeah, and I scratched the crap out of my car trying to get in and out of that thing. Yeah, wow. I don't like those hydraulic lift things.
That's
good intention,
bad, you know.
We need to do underground parking or something. Weird.
They have people that are doing, like, where you can rent people's driveways and stuff.
Oh,
you know, you pay,
I mean,
like,
just,
it's like, yeah, it's a whole, it's opening a whole nother
in
door.
In D.C., the parking spaces are separately deeded.
What?
Whoa.
Yeah. Wow.
Peep this. People buy parking spaces as investments.
That is wild.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And so people who live in houses that were built with no parking, because a lot of D.C. was built in, like, 1800s or, like, early 1900s, where not everybody had a car. So you, literally there's no driveway, nowhere to even put a car. It's just like a thing. They buy a separate parking space from a neighboring condo building or whatever that has a separate deed.
Wow. You know what? In the UK, there's, I mean, I don't know about whether or not they're separately deeded, but there's so little parking in several of the cities that, like, they have those apps where it's like you can book someone's parking space, you know, very easily. Like, you can book their driveway space very easily for... however long, you know, you choose the hour count, and it's very interesting.
I wonder what's going to get you more monthly rent. The rental parking space or the ADU? Like, in some neighborhoods, like, I lived in Koreatown, parking, impossible. Yeah. Impossible. Terrifying, in fact. Like, I'm, like, parking, like, down creepy streets that have no lighting, and I'd have to jump out and run. My car got... almost stolen multiple times. Like, the first people who tried to steal it messed it up so much that the second people who tried to steal it, all they got were my bags of CDs, which I'm sure those aren't very valuable now. I had some demos, some songs I can never get back, but you know, they just broke some windows and messed up the transmission. But anyway, terrifying. I wish I would have had parking or a way to rent somebody's spot, you know.
So that's something to consider when people are developing, is like, where are people going to park?
And yeah, I think you're right. And it's such a hard, like, question to answer, because they are valid, super valid points. So it's like, and then it's like, you think about the housing crisis as well. In the same time, it just feels like there's no...
But no, okay, this is a thing. Yeah, we can talk about that. We can talk about that.
Did I just
you pulled the thing out of the hand grenade.
This is something we talk about a lot. Because, you know, quite frankly, this is something that is propagandized so much, you know, but there are many spaces and places that are currently vacant because what's being built is so unaffordable that there aren't tenants, you know, filling it. But also, you know, in at least LA specifically, you know, the housing crisis has also been tied into the homelessness problem. Whereas yeah. when you really live in the depths of the, you know, places that are more affected by homelessness, you see that it's less about housing, because if you talk to these people, they're not looking to be housed. They enjoy their freedom. You know, many of them, a lot of people actually, I mean, you know, really it comes down to like a mental health thing, right? Which is what the city should be focusing on, is solving the mental health crisis, but then also the drug crisis.
Right.
Because that's another thing, is that even if they're, you know, mentally healthy otherwise, but on drugs, a lot of them have offers for housing, but refuse them because it also requires them to be clean, you know? So,
like fundamentally, there is no American right, like it's not like it's a right to live wherever you want at whatever price you feel you should pay. Like, I can't be like, it's my right to live in the Beverly Hills flats. It's my right. No, it is, because I want to, for $500. That's what I want. No, it's supply and demand. It's a market just like anything else.
It's true.
And the beautiful thing about real estate is, if you start without making excuses, look, this is where I am. I don't have shit. I don't have any money. Like I did. I figured out a way to get a very tiny place and then turn the tiny place into two bedroom apartment condo that I would prefer a big house, but this is what I can afford. And then turn that thing into another thing and work and do it. You can do it.
It's so true.
It's crazy. You can have it. You can do it. It's not your right.
Even with these ADU, you know, with these ADU laws, right? It's like, you know, people who want to take an asset and turn it into, you know, a foundation, they have options. You have options, you know. I would have loved to live in Baldwin Hills whenever I bought my house, but I could not afford Baldwin Hills, which was not even as pricey as it is right now, you know. But what I did was I bought a house that was much more affordable, you know, and I took out a renovation loan. I did it wasn't an FHA version, but it was a conventional version where it wrapped the financing of the reno that I otherwise would not have been able to pay for into the renovation. And, you know, and now I have something that actually I have equity in, and I can use that. And actually, I just got my ADU plans approved, and I'm going to take that equity and build that ADU so that now I have something that can produce income. And that's, you know, that's something that people can do. They just have to find the space to get into it.
Right.
You know, we're from Pennsylvania. We just got a property in Pennsylvania that's a great property and a very digestible price point, you know. But if you look at the rents there too, there are some super affordable. I mean, you are paying probably a sixth of what you would pay here for the same space. Wow. Your one bedroom apartment might be $600 instead of $3,000, you know, in that new building here. But, you know, that's possible too. So if you honestly cannot afford the city that you're in, explore other options, explore investing in other options.
Right.
Go buy a condo in Miami and rent it out. You know, those are $200,000-$300,000 depending on where you're looking, you know, or in Ohio where you might be able to pick it up for $100,000. You know, there are options. It's just that people don't like to explore their options and want what they want.
I think it's also a scary move to be buying somewhere where you don't live, where you feel like, I'm nowhere near there. When if something's happening, what do I do?
Right? You have a property management company.
No, Come on, I'm just talk to a realtor.
Excuses.
I think so too. But here's the other thing that's been recently seriously weaponized from a propaganda point of view, is like there are the oppressors and there are the oppressed. And this is happening in politics. It's happening with our wars that are happening. It's like, okay, we understand that there are people who have power and there are people who do not. But there is a way for you to get power if you stop that narrative and start with the possibility narrative, the abundance narrative. The opportunity is there for me. I just need to find it. How can I strategically make something out of nothing? Which, in my opinion, is the real American dream. Rich people buying property, they can do that all day long. And that's not going to stop. The people who have the gold make the rules. That's the golden rule, right? So how do I get to a place without attacking them, because we already know that's not a winning proposition, and find my own power in the system that exists already, which there are ways to do. Right. Exactly. Now there are ways to do.
But because the majority of people haven't had financial literacy classes or any education around buying real estate, leveraging real estate, anything around that, you know, instead of looking at it from an empowered standpoint, it's from a disempowered standpoint right. that looks at it like this unattainable thing that I'll never be able to get. Whereas, you know, and so, and that, that
that's
just,
what I mean.
Yeah, that just like further helps that propaganda land, because now you're talking to people who feel like you're empathizing with them, you know, but you're not telling them how they can join the, how they can join the appreciation, how they can, you know, build the foundation so they don't feel left behind but feel included. That's the real issue.
Yep. You know? I will never stand for people feeling stuck in this country of opportunity. Mm. We still have it. Let's exploit that. So if you want, it's a mindset thing too, I think. Mm. Yeah. So ADUs could be part of that.
I'm very inspired right now. I'm like, wow, where do I sign? I'm like, so powerful. Build your ADUs. Seriously, like, I want whatever you guys are thinking. Like, that's nice.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. That does it for another episode of Under All Is the Land. We'll see you next time.
Toodles.
Bye. Under all is the land. Under all.